Our next reading will be 1 week from tonight in this auditorium. It will be a reading to honor the students who are winners in this year's contest. That's the 28th at 8 o'clock here. There's a great deal going on this weekend. Shack's Press, tomorrow night, is sponsoring a reading by New Mexico poet Janet Rodney. And part of that, for part of that reading, she'll be joined by Joy Harjo and Keith Stoutenberg of playing saxophone and keyboard jazz. And very exciting event this weekend, the Tucson Poetry Festival. And they have tickets on sale here tonight for the festival. It begins on Friday night with a reading by Jane Miller and Ron Silliman. Saturday, there'll be small group discussions with all of the poets who are here in the morning and afternoon, open mic reading, a discussion at 3:30, and at 7:30, the readers will be Nathaniel Tarn and Edward Brathwaite. Sunday afternoon, the readers will be Meg Davis, Daphne Marlett, and Robert Creeley. Yeah. That's at the Scottish Rite Cathedral, 160 South Scott Avenue in the Downtown Arts District. So there'll be more information where the tickets will be on sale out in the hall. And please stay and have some brownies and tell Maxine Koomen how wonderful she is. We almost didn't invite Maxine this year because last time she came, my husband tried to run away with her, and I said, why should I put up with that again? She's both a poet and a novelist. Her most recent book of poetry is Nurture, and we have copies of Nurture on sale tonight. Her honors include a Pulitzer Prize and the appointment as a consultant to the Library of Congress. That appointment now is called the Poet Laureate of America. But they changed the title just recently. It's a great, great pleasure to have her back, Maxine Koomen.
Thank you very much. And that's just an ugly rumor that Lois is passing around. It's, Richard and I are prepared to deny. Where are you, Richard? Deny it. We're just good friends, right? I want to open the reading tonight with a poem, which is more a found poem. I had very little to do with the writing of it. It's true that the poet is a meddler, and I moved things around a little, and I did write the ending of it. But most of the language of this poem is found in a pamphlet that's published by the Canadian Minister of the Environment, and it is distributed throughout the parks of the Canadian Pacific Northwest. And the pamphlet and the poem have the same title, You Are in Bear Country. They've been here for thousands of years. You're the visitor. Avoid encounters. Think ahead. Keep clear of berry patches, garbage dumps, carcasses. On woods walks, bring noisemakers, bells, clap hands along the trail or sing, but in dense bush or by running water, bear may not hear your clatter. Whatever else, don't whistle. Whistling is thought by some to imitate the sounds bears make when they mate. You need to know there are two kinds, Ursus arctus horribilis, or grizzly, and Ursus americanus, the smaller black, said to be somewhat less likely to attack. Alas, a small horribilis is difficult to distinguish from a large americanus. Although there is no guaranteed life-saving way to deal with an aggressive bear, some ploys have proved more successful than others. Running's a poor choice. Bear can outrun a racehorse. Once you're face to face, speak softly, Take off your pack and set it down to distract the grizzly. Meanwhile, back slowly toward a large, sparsely branched tree. But remember, black bears are agile climbers, in which case a tree may not offer escape. As a last resort, you can play dead. Drop to the ground face down. In this case, wearing your pack may shield your body from attack. Courage, lie still. Sometimes your bear may veer away. If not, bears have been known to inflict only minor injuries upon the prone. Is death by bear to be preferred to death by bomb? Under these extenuating circumstances, your mind may make absurd leaps. The answer's yes. Come on in. Cherish your wilderness. Well, as it happens, the next poem is also about bears, and it picks up where that one leaves off. The hero of this poem is the man who has been attacked and has lived to tell his story. Unfortunately, he does not know the difference between lie and lay, in common with many of us. And there's a little reference to that in the poem, too. This poem is called In the Park. You have 49 days between death and rebirth if you're a Buddhist. Even the smallest soul could swim the English Channel in that time, or climb like a 10-month-old child every step of the Washington Monument to travel across, up, down, over, or through. You won't know till you get there which to do. He laid on me for a few seconds, said Roscoe Black, who lived to tell about his skirmish with a grizzly bear in Glacier Park. He laid on me, not doing anything. I could feel his heart beating against my heart. Never mind lie and lay, the whole world confuses them. For Roscoe Black, you might say, all 49 days flew by. I was raised on the Old Testament. In it, God talks to Moses, Noah, Samuel, and they answer. People confer with angels. Certain animals converse with humans. It's a simple world, full of crossovers. Heaven's an airy somewhere, and God has a nasty temper when provoked. But if there's a hell, little is made of it. No long-tailed devil. No eternal fire, and no choosing what to come back as. When the grizzly bear appears, he lays down on atheist and zealot. In the pitch dark, each of us waits for him in Glacier Park. Well, I will take advantage of your hospitality and read one more bear poem. This is not a metaphoric bear. The poem has a little epigraph from John McPhee, an essayist whose work I admire greatly, and he's done a wonderful essay on the black bears of western Pennsylvania. And in that essay he says, black bears are not particularly interested in flesh. They have been seen in the fields eating string beans. And that's where this poem is going to take off. I suppose I should say here in Arizona, where you might not know it, that Kentucky wonders are pole beans. It's called Encounter in August. Inside the teepee that admits sunlight to the underpart, he stands eating my Kentucky wonders, downs pod after pod, spilling the beans, the ones I'd saved for shelling out this winter, thinking soup. When he'd gone deep, denned up. This is not Eden, which ran unfenced and was not intercropped. Eden, where frost never overtook a patch. We stand 10 yards apart, two omnivores, not much interested in flesh. I think he ought to smell me through his greed, or hear my heart outbeat his steady chomp, but nothing interrupts his lunch. At last, he goes the way the skunk does, supreme egoist, ambling into the woodlot on all fours, leaving my trellis flat and beanless. And yet I find the trade-off fair, beans and more beans for this hour of bear. Now I'm going to go back and read some earlier, some kind of, you know, really early poems. One I like to read is a poem written in rhyming couplets that goes back to my adolescent years when I had a lot of fantasies about becoming a professional swimmer, and I didn't know I was going to be a poet. And it's called Morning Swim. Into my empty head there come a cotton beach, a dock wherefrom I set out oily and nude through mist in chilly solitude. There was no line, no roof or floor to tell the water from the air. Night fog, thick as terry cloth, closed me in its fuzzy growth. I hung my bathrobe on two pegs. I took the lake between my legs. Invaded and invader, I went overhand on that flat sky. Fish twitched beneath me, quick and tame. In their green zone, they sang my name. And in the rhythm of the swim, I hummed a 2-4 time slow hymn. I hummed, abide with me. The beat rose in the fine thrash of my feet, rose in the bubbles I put out slantwise, trailing through my mouth. My bones drank water. Water fell through all my doors. I was the well that fed the lake that met my sea, in which I sang, abide with me. A long time ago, I wrote a cycle of poems about a hermit. And I think there are 8 of them, and they're all written in the male persona, which I did only because I didn't think the world would take a female hermit seriously enough. So that in each case, the hermit is me. And since spring has come to Arizona, and it's not even too far away in New Hampshire, I'll read one. I did wake up this morning to wonderful mockingbird calls. It was such fun to lie there and hear a variety. I heard the red-winged blackbird, a sort of drunken red-winged blackbird. And then I heard a Bob White, which was just a little off the mark, and a little bit of a cardinal, and then some things I couldn't recognize. But it really made me long for that to happen in our woods. And this one is called The Hermit Wakes to Bird Sounds. He startles awake. His eyes are full of white light. In a minute, the sun will ooze into the sky. Meanwhile, all the machines of morning start up. The typewriter bird is at it again. Her style is full of endearing hesitations. The words, when they come, do so in the staccato rush of a deceitful love letter. The sewing machine bird returns to the doddering elm. Like Penelope, she rips out yesterday's stitches, only to glide up and down, front and back, re-entering the same needle holes. The bird who presides at the well house primes the pump. 2 gurgles, a pause, 4 squeaks of the handle, and time after time a promise of water can be heard falling back in the pipe's throat. Far off, the logging birds saw into heartwood with rusty blades, and the grouse cranks up his eternally unstartable Model T, and the oil can bird comes with his liquid pock, pock, to attend to the flinty clanks of the disparate parts. And as the old bleached sun slips into position, slowly the teasing, inept, malfunctioning, one-of-a-kind machines falls silent. There's something very seductive about writing a cycle of poems, because you have that enduring hope that what doesn't fit into one is going to, you know, turn up and be useful in another. And really on the heels of writing the Hermit poems, I wrote a cycle of poems about an old horse. And the horse's name being Amanda. And I guess I'll just read this one, which has a rather long, pretentious title and is itself quite small. It's called Amanda Dreams She Has Died and Gone to the Elysian Fields. This morning, Amanda lies down during breakfast. The hay is hip high. The sun sleeps on her back as it did on the spine of the dinosaur, the fossil bat, the first fish with feet she was once. A breeze fans the deer flies from lighting. Only a gaggle of gnats housekeeps in her ears. A hay plume sticks out of her mouth. I come calling with a carrot from which I have taken the first bite. She startles. She considers rising, but retracts the pistons of her legs and accepts as loose-lipped as a camel. We sit together. In this time and place, we are heart and bone. For an hour, we are incorruptible. Probably a good place to put in this next poem occurs right after that one. This was a request, but I like to read it to an academic audience because it has a four-letter word in it, and I feel I have to do my part to play catch-up with my male colleagues whose poems are littered with four-letter words. So this is called the excrement poem. It is done by us all as God disposes, from the least cast of worm to what must have been, in the case of the brontosaur, say, spoor of considerable heft, something awesome. We eat, we evacuate, survivors that we are. I think these things each morning with shovel and rake, drawing the risen brown buns toward me, fresh from the horse oven, as it were. Or culling the alfalfa green ones expelled in a state of ooze through the sawdust bed to take a serviceable form as putty does so as to lift out entire from the stall. And wheeling to it, storming up the slope, I think of the angle of repose the manure pile assumes, how sparrows come to pick the re-delivered grain, how inky cap caprinus mushrooms spring up in a downpour. I think of what drops from us and must then be moved to make way for the next and next. However much we stain the world, spatter it with our leavings, make stenches, defile the great formal oceans with what leaks down. Trundling off today's last barrowful, I honor shit for saying, we go on. Thank you. Well, while I'm being scatological, I'll read another. This is a kind of an excremental vision. This was the poem that got me in so much trouble when I was at the Library of Congress because I was attacked by the Heritage Foundation as a pornographic poet. And since I always got off the elevator on the third floor, which is where the poetry office at the Library of Congress is, it's a floor labeled attic in the elevator, and I used to whistle walking down the hall, the two women who constitute my staff and are my dear friends would say, aha, the whistling pornographer returns. This poem is called, this is sort of an anti-animal experimentation poem called Heaven as Anus. In the Defense Department, there is a shop where scientists sew the eyelids of rabbits open lest they blink in the scorch of a nuclear drop. And elsewhere, dolphins are being taught to defuse bombs in the mock-up of a harbor, and monkeys learn to perform the simple tasks of draftees. It is done with electric shocks. Some mice who have failed their time tests in the maze now go to the wire unbidden for their jolts. Implanting electrodes yields rich results. Alley cats turn from predators into prey. Show them a sparrow and they cower. while the white wall labs fill up with the feces of fear, where calves whose hearts have been done away with walk and bleat on plastic pumps. And what is any of this to the Godhead? These squeals, whines, writhings, unexpected jumps, whose children burn alive, booby-trap the dead, lop ears and testicles, core and disembowel. It all ends at the hole. No words may enter the house of excrement. We will meet there as the sphincter of the good Lord opens wide, and he takes us all inside. Thank you. Well, now we've brought God into it. Don't tell Jesse Helms, okay. Fortunately, I'm not facing what the recipients of this year's grants are facing, where they have to sign a loyalty oath. That's really true. I mean, it would be a terrific position to be in as a writer, to have to make that decision to give up the whatever it is, $17,000 or $20,000, yeah. Anyway, I spent 6 weeks as writer in residence at a small college in Danville, Kentucky, which was a wonderful, you know, Thoreau says at one point in Walden, which is my Bible, he says, one need not go halfway round the world to count the cats in Zanzibar, which is now Tanzania. Extra vegans, it depends how one is yarded. And I found the extra vegans in Danville, Kentucky. I had never lived in Pentecostal country before, and it was quite a revelation. This poem is called The Jesus Infection. Jesus is with me on the Bluegrass Parkway going eastbound. He is with me on the old Harrodsburg Road coming home. I am listening to country gospel music in the borrowed Subaru. The gas pedal and the words leap to the music. Oh, throw out the lifeline. Someone is drifting away. Flags fly up in my mind without my knowing where they've been lying furled, and I am happy living in the sunlight where Jesus is near. A man is driving his polled Herefords across the gleanings of a cornfield, while I am bound for the kingdom of the free. At the little trestle bridge that has no railing, I see that I won't have to cross Jordan alone. Signposts every mile exhort me to get right with God, and I move over. There's a neon message blazing at the crossroad, catty corner to the Burger Queen, ye come with me. Is it well with my soul, Jesus? It sounds so easy to be happy after the sunrise, to be washed in the crimson flood. Now I am tailgating, and I read a bumper sticker on a Ford truck full of Poland Chinas. It says, honk if you know Jesus, and I do it. My sound blats out for miles behind the pig squeal, and it's catching in the front end, in the axle, in the universal joint, this rich contagion. We are going down the valley on a hairpin turn. The swine and me, we're breakneck in, we're leaning on the everlasting arms. Well, I know that some of you are aware of the fact that the late Ann Sexton and I were very close personal friends and very close professional friends. And after her death, although I had vowed I would not do so, I found that I was writing elegies to her name. What's interesting to me is how these change. The first several ones are apostrophes, that is, direct address to the absent one. And so I think I'll read two. I'm going to read one of these early ones, and then I'm going to read a recent one. Although it may be hard to get into this since it's so wintry, it's called Splitting Wood at Six Above, which is the best time to split wood. Once it's below freezing, wood splits much more easily. And it contains a passage about paying for an expensive long-distance call. It was our habit to talk on the phone every day, and when one of us was out of town, we called after 5, but we still might be on the phone for 45 minutes or an hour. And then we would split the phone bill at the end of the month. And back then, even, I can remember paying phone bills of $250, $300 for a month apart. That's just background for this. Splitting wood at 6 above. I open a tree. In the stupefying cold, ice on bare flesh a scald, I seat the metal wedge with a few left-handed swipes. Then, with a change of grips, lean into the 8-pound sledge. It's muslin overhead. Snow falls as heavy as salt. You are 4 months dead. The beech log comes apart like a chocolate nougat. The wood speaks first in the tiny voice of a bird cry, a puppet squeak, and then all in a rush, all in a passionate stammer. The papery soul of the beech, released by wedge and hammer, flies back into air. Time will do this as fair to hickory, birch, black oak, easing the insects in till rot and freeze combine to raise out of wormwood cracks, blue and dainty, the souls. They are thin as an eyelash. They flap once, going up. The air rings like a bell. I breathe out drops, cold morning ghost puffs like your old cigarette cough. See you tomorrow, you said. You lied. We're far from finished. I'm still talking to you. Last night's dream. We'll split the phone bill. It's expensive calling from the other side. Even waking, it seems logical. Your small, round, stubbornly airborne soul, that sun-yellow daisy heart slipping the noose of its pod, scooting over the tightrope, none the worse for its trip to arrive at the other side. It is the sound of your going. I drive into heartwood. I stack my quartered cuts, bark down, open yellow face. There are a number of these poems, and there's one in the new book, In Nurture, and I thought I might then read this, because this is the first time in which it isn't a you poem. This is a very detached, third-person poem, and I have never found it possible to write a poem to specification, to spec, as it were, and in this case, I was asked to write a poem, and 3 or 4 or 5 months elapsed, long after the magazine had been published, and suddenly came the poem. So it's called On Being Asked to Write a Poem in Memory of Anne Sexton. The elk discards his antlers every spring. They rebud, they grow. They are growing an inch a day to form a rococo rack with a 5-foot spread, even as we speak. Cartilage at first, covered with velvet, bendable, tender, gristle, yet destined to ossify, the velvet sloughed off, hanging in tatters from alders and scrub growth. No matter how hardened, it seems there was pain, blood on the snow from rubbing, rubbing, rubbing. What a heavy candelabrum to be borne forth, each year more elaborately turned. The special issues, the prizes in her name. Above the mantle, the late elk's antlers gleam. And just because I think it's interesting to follow the thread, you know, of someone once said, oh, the poet has one song and sings it over and over, and there's really a lot, an enormous truth to that. So I thought I'd kind of display this poem, which is too new to have been collected yet. And it's called The Green Well. It's very elegiac. June, 5 a.m., before the sun retakes its dips and humps, light rims the field with an aura. Gnats form an ectoplasmic cloud over the bruised bathtub, over the salt lick hollowed out by tongues like medieval stairs petitioners' feet have worn looking for the truth. I hold truth in a nine lives can twice weekly for the cats whose paws explore the lips and sills of stalls so deftly that they never need encounter the grounded dogs. Today, a newly dead red squirrel hugs the top of the feed bin, recompense exact. Thanks, Abra. Thank you, Kadabra, for doing God's work. Fledglings, field mice, shrews, moles, baby rabbits. Else why would he have made so many? I bury what I deplore in the manure pile, deep in that warm brown digester to be flung next fall on the meadow, then let myself down rung by rung into the green well of losses, a kitchen midden where the newly dead, layer by layer, overtake the long and longer vanished. Gone now to tankage my first saved starveling mare and the filly we tore from her in the rain. After the lethal phenobarb, the vet exchanged my check for his handkerchief. Nine live foals since, and I'm still pocked with grief, with how they lay on their sides, half dry, half wet. Grief, sir, is a species of idleness, a line we treasured out of Bellow, my suicided long-term friend and I. All these years I've fought somehow to bless her drinking in of the killer car exhaust, but a coal of anger sat and winked its live orange eye undimmed in my chest while the world buzzed, gossiping in the hive. That mare, a dangerous runaway, her tongue thickly scarred by wire. My friend, too, fleeing her wolves, her voices, those voodoo doctors could not still nor save her from. It does not end with us, though end it will. A hapless swallow lays another clutch of eggs in the accessible nest. The cats elaborately clean themselves after the kill. Thank you. Well, I think we need something a little lighter after that, and read a couple of what I call my tribal poems. This is really my sex misinformation poem. I wrote this poem for my mother's 82nd birthday. It's just called Birthday Poem. I am born at home, the last of four children. The doctor brings me, as promised, in his snap-jawed black leather satchel. He takes me out in sections, fastens limbs to torso, torso to neck stem, pries mama's navel open, and inserts me head first. Chin back, I swim upward up the alimentary canal, bypassing mouth and nose holes, and knock at the top of her head to be let out, wherefore her little bald spot. Today, my mother is 82, splendidly braceleted and wigged. She had to go four times to the well to get me. And I'll read another one out of this group. This one is called Sunbathing on a Rooftop in Berkeley. 11 palm trees stand up between me and the bay. A quarter turn and I'm in line with Campanile Tower. The hippies are sunbathing too. They spread themselves out on the sidewalks with their ingenious crafts for sale and their humble puppies. We are all pretending summer is eternal. Mount Tamalpais hovers in the distance. I pinch myself that this is California, but behind my light-struck eyelids, I am also a child again in an amusement park in Pennsylvania, and 40 years blow in and out, adapting as the fog does to conditions in the bay. My daughter has gone to her class in criminal procedure. She pulls her hair back in a twist. Maybe she will marry the young man she lives with. I take note how severely she regards the laws of search and seizure. She moves with the assurance of a cheetah. Still, marriage may be the sort of entrapment she wishes to avoid. She is all uncertainties, as I am in this mothering business. Oh, summers without end. The exact truth is, we are expanding sideways as haplessly as in the mirrors of the fun house. We bulge toward the separate fates that await us, sometimes touching as sleeves will, whether or not a hug was intended. Oh, summers without end. The truth is, no matter how I love her, death blew up my dress that day while she was in the egg, unconsidered. And again, I guess this will illustrate what I said about the one song. This is a different daughter, and it's called We Stood There Singing. This takes place in just outside of Geneva, Switzerland, in the French Alps, where we are going, climbing up to one of the stud farms for a horse which was has all been for, I guess, since the Middle Ages, the, you know, the prime and unspoiled breed of the Swiss Army. And it's sort of a light draft animal. They ride them and they drive them, they use them to pull. Le Bon Roi Dagobert is a children's song in French. It's all about this, the good king Dagobert, who's not quite all there. And the good Saint Louis, who looks after him. In the very first stanza, the king has put his pants on backwards, and, you know, in succeeding stanzas, he does other ridiculous things, and Saint Louis kind of bails him out. We stood there singing. On a gray day in March in his first year, we drove up out of orderly Geneva, mother and daughter and the daughter's child, up the hairpin turns of the Chasseral, in search of the horses of the Franche Montagne, with feathered fetlocks and manes blown wild, each splashed white face the same kind eye said to persist unchanged since Charlemagne. The baby slept, tipped sideways in his chair, slept through sudden snow squalls that blanked the alpine road like a stage scrim, and woke up cranky in Les Brûleurs, where at the village's one store we stopped to take our bearings. When he howled, the aproned woman invited us back past vats of sauerkraut and wheels of cheese into their bedroom. I remember that plain space of rough white plaster, oaken crucifix, oak beams overhead, runner of tatted lace on the chest of drawers. I remember the lambskin she unrolled on the bed, motioning you to lay him down. And after he was done up sweet with powder, she opened her arms and bounced him chortling around the room, singing him bits of Le Bon Roi Dagobert. We stood there singing. I remember that moment of civility among women. The beginning of my brief stay here, I read one poem which came from a series I wrote when my brother's, the next in line to me, and there were four of us in the family, died of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, which was a long and terrible dying. And I read one poem at that time, and I'd like to read a different one tonight. You do need to know that when you get to these L words, these flowers that all have L's in them, that what we're looking at is more L's than the word needs, okay? The poem is called The Man of Many L's. My whole childhood I feared cripples and how they got that way. The one-legged lavender man who sold his sachets by St. Mary's steeple. The blind who tapped past humming what they knew. Even the hunchback seamstress, a rag doll who further sagged to pin my mother's hems, had once been sturdy, had once been whole. Something entered people, something chopped, pressed, punctured, had its way with them. And if you looked bad, child, it entered you. When we found out what the disease would do, lying like any council's stalwarts, all of us swore to play our parts in the final act at your command. The first was easy. You gave up your left hand, and the right grew wiser, a juggler for its king. When the poor, dumb leg began to falter, you took up an alpenstock for walking once flourished Sundays by our dead father. Month by month, the battleground grew thinner. When you could no longer swallow meat, we steamed and mashed your dinner and bent your straw to chocolate soda treats. And when you could not talk, still you could write questions and answers on a magic slate, then lift the page like laundry to the wind. I plucked the memory splinter from your spine as we played at being normal, who had eased each other in the cold zoo of childhood. 3 months before you died, I wheeled you through the streets of placid Palo Alto to catch spring in its flamboyant tracks. You wrote the name of every idiot flower I did not know. Yucca rained, mimosa shone. The bottle brush took fire as you fought to hold your great head on its stem. Lilac, you wrote, magnolia, lily, and further, oleander, delphinium. Oh, man of many L's, brother, my wily resident ghost, may I never spell these crowfoot dogbane words again. These showy, florid words again, except I name them under your spell. One, I think maybe one last of the tribal group. This is quite a bit lighter. It's a little lyric called Appetite. I eat these wild red raspberries, still warm from the sun and smelling faintly of jewel weed, in memory of my father, tucking the napkin under his chin and bending over an ironstone bowl of the bright druplets awash in cream. My father, with the sigh of a man who has seen all and been redeemed, said time after time as he lifted his spoon, men kill for this. And this is a moose poem. It's also about Thoreau. The word camelopard was an early word in our language that was used to describe the giraffe. That's the only thing that needs to be glossed. And it's called My Elusive Guest. Thoreau loved the grayness of them, homespun with leafy horns like lichen made of bone. God's own horses, poor timid creatures, he said, in 1846 in the Maine woods, and then went on to wonder why they stood so high at the shoulders, why so long ahead, no tail to speak of. How like the camelopard, he said, rolling the archaic word on his tongue, high before and low behind, and stayed admiring them upwind. 100 years later, the widow Blau, whose rock-bound farm I now inhabit, broomed a moose out of her kitchen garden, thinking it the neighbor's brown cow marauding among the vegetables at dawn. Then looked up to behold those rabbit ears, that wet, nearsighted eye, that ferny rack of gray on a still gray sky, and none since. Spring mornings at first light, sometimes through fog, some heavy weight shifts and wavers against the line of trees, and wanting it in my blood like a spray of musk, I beckon the elusive guest, willing it close, my wild thing, my moose. And I think I'll go back to the new book and perhaps read a couple of these animal poems. This is a poem about a dog who is no longer among the living, a wonderful dog, however. It's called Custodian, and this is really a biographical, very accurate picture. Every spring when the ice goes out, black commas come scribbling across the shallows. Soon they sprout four legs. Slowly they absorb their tails, and by mid-June, full-voiced, announce themselves. Enter our spotted dog. Every summer, tense with the scent of them, tail arced like a pointer's but wagging in anticipation, he stalks his frogs 200 yards clockwise around the perimeter of this mucky pond, then counterclockwise, an old pensioner happy in his work. Once every 10 or so pounces, he succeeds, carries his captive north in his soft mouth, uncorks him on the grass, and then sits, head cocked, watching the slightly dazed amphibian hop back to sanctuary. Over the years, the pond's inhabitants seem to have grown accustomed to this ritual of capture and release. They ride untroubled in the wet pocket of the dog's mouth, disembark in the meadow like hitchhikers, and strike out again for home. I have seen others of his species kill and swallow their catch and then be seized with violent retchings. I have seen children corner pollywogs in the sun-flecked hollow by the green rock and lovingly squeeze the life out of them in their small fists. I have seen the great blue heron swoop in time after wing-slapping time to carry frogs back to the fledglings in the rookery. Nothing is to be said here of need or desire. No moral arises, nor is this probably purgatory. We have this old dog, custodian of an ancient race of frogs, doing what he knows how to do, and we too taking and letting go that same story. This one is, of course, as you will hear, inspired by watching one of those television documentaries on Africa. It's called Catchment. When the she-leopard stalks and pounces on an infant antelope, which one am I rooting for? The newborn I saw slip moments ago, free from the birth canal, struggle to its feet, stagger against its mother's teat and begin to nurse both nervously twitching tail stubs in the heat and flies of the equator, or the big cat in whose camouflaged lair three helpless youngsters wait, so starved for meat that she dares venture out to hunt by daylight. I watch this living color film unfold with a friend whose English bull mastiff pup, as if New Hampshire were the veldt, as if its life depended on the chase, leapt up last month to snatch a newborn doe kid from her arms and snapped its neck with one good shake. Later, watching the afterglow flush the whole sky pink, then darken, we can almost discuss it, good and harm. Nature, a catchment of sorrows. We hug each other, no lesson drawn. One more from that group. I wanted to call this nurture book Sleeping with Animals, but Viking is a very timorous publisher, and they thought that sounded too kinky. And we also had a big argument about this cover, which I think belongs on a personal hygiene product. But I lost that battle too. So I want especially to read this poem, Sleeping with Animals. Nightly I choose to keep this covenant with a wheezing broodmare who, 10 days past due, grunts in her sleep in the vocables of the vastly pregnant. She lies down on sawdust of white pine, its terp smell blending with the rich scent of ammonia and manure. I, in my mummy bag just outside her stall, observe the silence louder than the catch in her breathing, observe gradations of the ancient non-editorial dark. Against the open doorway looking south, observe the paddock posts become a chain gang, each one shackled leg and wrist, the pasture wall a graveyard of bones that ground fog lifts and swirls. Sleeping with animals, loving my animals too much, letting them run like a perfectly detached statement by Mozart through all the other lines of my life, a handsome family of serene horses glistening in their thoughtlessness. Fear ghosts me still for my two skeletons, one stillborn foal 8 years ago, one hours old, dead of a broken spine. Five others swam like divers into air, dropped on clean straw, were whinnied to, tongued dry, and staggered stagey drunkards to their feet, nipped and nudged by their mothers to the teat. Restless, dozy, between occasional coughs, the mare takes note of me and knickers, heaves herself up, explores the corners of her feed tub, sleeps a little, leg joints locked. I shine my light across the bar to watch the immense contours of her flanks rise and fall. Each double inhale is threaded to the life that still holds back in its safe sack. What we say to each other in the cold black of April, conveyed in a wordless yet perfect language of touch and tremor, connects us most surely to the wet cave we all once burst from, gasping, naked or furred, into our separate species. Everywhere on this planet, birth, everywhere curled in the amnion and unborn wonder. Together we wait for this still clenched burden. I think just two more poems will bring us up to time. I'll read the title poem, and then I'll read one new poem, and that will be it. What I wanted on the cover was a wonderful photograph that was in Smithsonian Magazine of an orphan kangaroo being nursed, being fed milk out of a doll-sized bottle. And the scale of the human hand and the little Joey was so terrific, but Viking rejected it. They said it was too fetal-looking, which is to say it wasn't pretty. So that's why we have Bambi on the cover. There's no Bambi in this book. This poem is called Nurture, and I just want to say about it that it really was a 19th century romantic notion that there had been a wild child. There is no documentation for this, despite the Romulus and Remus legend that a she-wolf nursed them and they went on to found Rome and so on. Nurture. From a documentary on marsupials, I learned that a pillowcase makes a fine substitute pouch for an orphaned kangaroo. I am drawn to such dramas of animal rescue. They are warm in the throat. I suffer, the critic proclaims, from an overabundance of maternal genes. Bring me your fallen fledgling, your bummer lamb. Lead the abused, the starvelings into my barn. Advise the hunted deer to leap into my corn. And had there been a wild child, filthy and fierce as a ferret, he is called in one 19th century account. A wild child to love, it is safe to assume, given my fireside inked with paw prints, there would have been room. Think of the language we two, same and not same, might have constructed from sign, scratch, grimace, grunt, vowel. Laughter, our first noun, and our long verb, howl. Thank you. And I'm going to close on what I hope is going to be the title poem of a new book. It's called Looking for Luck in Bangkok. Often at markets, I see people standing in line to walk under an elephant. They count out a few coins, then crouch to slip beneath the wrinkly umbrella that smells of dust and old age and a thousand miracles. They unfold on the other side, blessed with long life, good luck, solace from grief, unruly children, and certain liver complaints. Conspicuous Caucasian, I stoop to take my turn. The feet of my elephant are stout as planted pines. His trunk completes this honest structure, this tractable, tusked, and deeply creased endangered shelter. I squat in his aromatic shade, reminded of stale bedclothes, my mother's pantry shelves of cloves and vinegar, as if there were no world of drought, no parasites, no ivory poachers, my good luck running in as his runs out. Thank you.